So the talk that I'll have today is kind of a culmination of my PhD research, and it involves quite a few topics. So, but with this, the title kind of summarizing the theme. So in most of these works, I won't go into a lot of detail because I kind of want to give kind of an overarching story. But at any time, feel free to stop me if there's something that you want to talk to in more detail. So I'll start a bit general and describe what I mean by compact objects, which I think everyone's well familiar with. So compactness for spherical objects is simply the mass divided by its radius. And black holes can give a limit to this of the order of 1/2, which is just the mass divided by its Schwarzschild radius. But in the case of neutron stars, this is not so well defined. We know that it'll be less than this, that of a black hole. But the compactness is restricted by the equation of state that's used to describe this matter, which is still a significant unknown that we'll talk about more. However, the most important aspect of this is the fact that the mass, as well as its compactness, describes how space-time is curved and in these regions. And therefore, the coalescence and the collision of these objects are sources of gravitational radiation that are potentially loud enough for us to observe. Now, with neutron stars, these objects by themselves are, of course, interesting. And if there's nuclear physicists in the room, they'd be able to describe the nuclear equation of state better than I. But we know that the composition of a neutron star by itself is not only fascinating, but there's portions of it that are unknown and that are the topic of a lot of my research, as well as many others. One thing that we do know from pulsar observations, which is this plot on the right, which is the standard, what's called PP dot diagram. So we have the spin period along the x-axis and the spin down rate on the y-axis. And the diagonal lines going from left to right is in terms of magnetic field strength, which all the works that I'll talk about today do not take magnetic fields into consideration. And going kind of upwards from left to right is the life of the pulsar. So it's expected how old the pulsar is. The thing that I want to draw your attention to is this lower left corner, where all the points with circles around them are actually denoting pulsars that are in known binary configurations. So it's important to note that studying these very fast rotators, which are also the bottom left corner, are also in known binary configurations. So studying them from a numerical relativity perspective in a binary configuration is very meaningful and could have important consequences for multi-messenger observations. Now, as I said, I'm a numerical relativist. And what that means is that we try to find these solutions to Einstein field equations to study merger and post-merger dynamics of binary objects. To do that, we have to take this nice compact form of Einstein's field equations and we have to decompose it using the standard 3+1 decomposition, where our nice manifold is now in purely spatial slices that are parameterized by some time component. In this way, we can define a Cauchy problem where we have an initial data solution, which is the t equals zero problem. And then we have the evolution problem, which is the evolution of this initial data slice. Now, this mapping is not unique. There's a wide variety of formulations. The evolution side, I won't discuss at all today, but on the initial data side, which is actually a fairly significant problem, I will discuss our solution to this, which is based off the extended conformal thin sandwich approximation. So what are we interested in when I say extremal binary compact object configurations? Well, we want to look at binaries that consist of black holes and neutron stars. We want to look at mass ratios that are much, much less than one. So in my case, my notation is the mass ratio that is equal mass is one, and more asymmetric is less than one. And we want to look at situations where the dimensionless spins of these objects are not equal to each other and are not zero. Or we at least want that capability. Okay, and we want to not be restricted as far as what spins we look at. So in the case of a binary, for a black hole, the maximal limit for conformal initial data is on the order of 0.85. And for a neutron star, this is on the order of 0.65, where I defined the dimensionless spin parameter here, which is just the spin angular momentum divided by the mass squared. Quasi-equilibrium binaries are interesting to look at because we can compare that with post-Newtonian approximations. For many of us know that eccentricity is an important parameter to control, and so we want to be able to control this parameter. Obviously, we want the linear momentums to be minimized because we don't want our binaries to float off of our grid, and we want to be able to export this to an evolution framework, preferably in an easy way. So our answer to this was actually the multi-year effort that ended up in the Frankfurt University Cadet Initial Data Codes, or FUCA for short. And this is a suite of initial data solvers that are based off the Cadet Spectral Solver Library, which is designed specifically for numerical relativity. So what does this new numerical implementation look like? Well, FUCA uses an extended version of Cadet, which myself and my colleague Jens Poppenforth modified. And it solves the XCTS formulation that I mentioned earlier. And we generate the initial data for black holes using excision conditions as opposed to puncture conditions. And the neutron stars we're able to construct either using piecewise polytropic equation of state or tabulated equations of state. This is incredibly important for a highly dynamic field such as equation of state analysis, which we'll talk about more. So we want to be able to use the state of the art as they come about. And finally, Cadet utilizes a novel multi-grid setup based off bispherical coordinates, which is this little, you know, rabbit plot that we have here, where this is an asymmetric binary black hole configuration. And you see you have two spheres that are surrounding the black holes with this bispherical decomposition matching these two spheres to an outer compactified spherical domain, which is this light gray, light green region, which uses a coordinate system that goes to, I would say, numerical infinity. And in this way, we're actually able to compute asymptotic quantities very accurately. So just to be transparent, the formulation that we use to solve the initial data is the XCTS formulation. And so here, the left-hand side of these equations, I have my little mouse pointer, left-hand side is essentially our geometry, and the right-hand side are our source terms. So since we're restricted to neutron stars currently, our source terms are just computed based off the conservation equations of energy momentum tensor and rest mass density, which are also have to be decomposed into the 3+1 notation. So some initial results, just to give some, I would say, confidence in what we're able to compute. As I mentioned, Cadet is a purely spectral solver. And so what that means is that in the ideal case with a spectral solver, as you increase the effective resolution of your solution, you would expect to see exponential decrease in the error. So what I have here are four quantities that are computed from the initial data slice, where this is the ADM mass, the Komar mass, and the angular momentum, and then the angular velocity of the binary, which is omega. And we measure these at some lower resolution. We compare it to the solution that we obtain at a very high resolution, which is outside of this graph. And we see the expected exponential convergence. Likewise, we can compare quasi-equilibrium configurations for a various number of binary configurations. So we have both, or well, all three BNS, BBH, and BHNS configurations with different mass ratios. And we can compare them to fourth order post-Newtonian estimates, which we see excellent agreement for. And finally, we can look at the error in the evolution that we introduced from our initial data. So this is the relative difference of the evolution, or I'm sorry, the relative difference of the phase of the gravitational waveform as compared to, and we'll say a run that's at high resolution initial data and evolution resolution. And what you see here is that as we, in the first two lines, as we decrease the resolution of the initial data, we do see a change in the phase of the waveforms. And then the top two lines are with a different evolution resolution, but with the same high initial data resolution. And this is just to show that in all cases, the evolution resolution dominates as the error source in our simulations.
So may I ask you a question?
Sure.
So this really great agreement with the post-Newtonian, I mean, so post-Newtonian defines masses different from the way you would define in GR. I mean, there is an ambiguity there. So are you in some sense surprised that it agrees this well? I mean, is there any particular fit or, yeah, so how do you deal with that? Because the ambiguity is there.
Yeah, so in our case, so whenever we talk about the total mass of the system, we're always talking about it in terms of the component masses. And so in our case, the, you know, if you want to talk about binary neutron stars, the component masses are always the total gravitational mass at what we'd say infinite separation. So essentially you compute the TOV solutions in isolation, and then you sum those two gravitational masses together, because of course, as you bring the objects closer together, you're gonna have some, their gravitational masses will change due to the interaction with the companion. And there's no well-defined way to measure this stuff quasi-locally. Like you can make some approximate quasi-local measurements of the gravitational mass of the neutron star, but it's really not accurate, and you'll see a systematic deviation between the two measurements. And so, but in this way, by using the gravitational mass at infinite separation for each of the objects and saying that's the total mass, it functions the same way. And there's no, I would say, special scaling or anything that needs to be done when using the post-Newtonian estimates.
How about the binding energy? How are you defining the binding energy on your slides?
Yeah, so the binding energy is you take the sum of the component mass, the component gravitational masses, and then you subtract it from the ADM mass of the binary. So you take the total energy in the system in the binary configuration, and then you subtract off the component masses, and that's what gives you the binding energy in this plot.
Okay.
Yeah, and I would say this has been from the initial data community, this has been a well-defined measurement that has been kind of the staple for being able to say if your initial data is correct or not, as well as at what point do post-Newtonian estimates kind of fall off, because you can continue this plot to shorter separation distance. Because this is the other way you can read this, is the upper left-hand corner here is larger separations and you decrease to shorter separations here. And at some point, especially for mainly for binary black holes, you can actually see where the post-Newtonian estimates are no longer able to describe the initial data time slice anymore due to, yeah, GR effects. No? Okay.
So sorry, may I ask a question?
Please.
Thank you. Yeah, in the previous slide, when you mentioned like how you distribute the previous to that one, my apologies, here, you mentioned at some point numerical infinity. What do you exactly mean with that?
So, it's just the coordinate mapping here. So because it's a, you know, in each of the multi-grid setups, you're essentially, you are taking your physical coordinate system and then you're mapping it to a numerical one. And in this case, you can take, you know, what you would say is your physical infinity, and you're just converting it into something that can be handled numerically. So as like one over R or something like that. And so then at infinity, you would essentially end up with one. And then at your boundary to the compactified domain with your bispherical boundaries, you're at some other finite radius. And then it's just a matter of transforming these things back to physical coordinates later.
Okay, but then in terms of the physical ones, you would be getting infinitely far away.
Right, but in the case of, I mean, everything is computed on the numerical grid. And so when you interpolate, you're never interpolating out to infinity. You know, you can, if you put in some Cartesian coordinates, and say, okay, plug this into my interpolating function solution. What's my, you know, what are my my metric variables going to be? You can get a response back. But I mean, you're never actually computing the physical infinity from the solution, right? It's just a mapping.
Okay, yeah, thank you very much.
Yeah. So we're not taking it out to scry. Okay, so yeah, so we did a number of evolutions in our paper, but the most, I would say the most pressing one that kind of encapsulates everything is with related to binary neutron stars. And so in this case, we have in the upper panel, we have a binary neutron star system. Well, both cases, we have the same configuration where the mass of the primary is a 2.2 solar mass and the mass of the secondary is one. And for the equation of state that we're using, the maximum non-rotating mass is, I believe, 2.23. So the primary is right at the, you know, very close to the maximum mass that can be supported by the equation of state without rotation. In the first row, we have a non-rotating massive star. And in the second row, we have a massively rotate, we have an extremely rotating, so a chi of 0.6. I'm sorry, it's hard to read, but it's a chi of 0.6 on the primary. And the secondary is always irrotational in this case. In the middle panel, we show the separation distance as a function of time, where the blue line is the initial data slice computed with 3.5 post-Newtonian estimates for the orbital velocity and what's called the radial infall velocity. And these are 2 degrees of freedoms that can be used to produce eccentricity reduced data. And it's important to note that in this, we're still using post-Newtonian estimates for non-rotating objects. There are spin, and spin orbital corrections that could be produced or could be added, but those haven't been. So that's kind of why you see in the first line or in the first row that the 3.5 estimates are better than in the second one, because in the second one we have this this addition of spin. But the red line is using what's known as eccentricity reduction techniques, which if you're interested, I can discuss, but I don't think it's important for this talk. But we can show that with eccentricity reduction, we can get, you know, a quasi-circular, a more circular in spiral. And now the left column and the right column are plots that are based off of this eccentricity reduced data set, so this ECC4. And so on the left plot, it's just the left column is just the orbital track. And on the right column, we have the 2-2, the L equal M equals 2 multipole of the plus polarization of the strain. And the interesting thing from this is that even with a primary that's essentially at the maximum mass and the total mass of the binary is well above what would be needed to promptly collapse to a black hole at merger, in the second case, the addition of spinning angular momentum on the primary is actually enough to result in a quasi-stable remnant. So this led us to a lot of questions as far as to what degree can asymmetry and spin result in something that's a metastable remnant post-merger? Now, the idea of threshold mass I'll discuss quickly, or I'll just discuss briefly. So threshold mass is essentially the minimum mass that's needed in order for a binary neutron star system to promptly form a black hole at merger. There is no first principle way of defining this. And there's a lot of, I would say, qualitative behaviors that have evolved over time in order to define this in numerical simulations, in order to give what we believe is our reliable results. And I believe that the work I'll discuss later kind of extends on those. But this is not a new field of research. This is actually a very long one. So at least from, I'd say, 2010. But the equal mass irrotational case has been studied very, very thoroughly, especially since 2013. With papers even up until 2020. And the mass asymmetric but still irrotational objects has been a point of more recent research. But this is important because, you know, if you imagine that you have two neutron stars that merge and directly form a black hole, that there's no time for any sort of neutrino radiation from the hypermassive neutron star. And so I would say the current accepted understanding of the post-merger physics is that you can't have a blue component of your kilonova without this additional radiation from the hypermassive neutron star. And so understanding where this prompt collapse threshold is can give you an understanding as far as like, do we expect to see a blue kilonova or not, which is important from a multi-messenger standpoint. And understanding where this prompt collapse threshold is can give us an understanding of what the equation of state of nuclear matter is, which I'll talk about a bit more later. So with this in mind, we did one study that focused on, I would say, the extremes of binary neutron stars. And we did it with two equations of state with a total of about 28 simulations. And in this case, the axes, so along here we have mass ratio. Along the other, on the x-axis, we can say we have the spin parameter of the primary. Again, in all of these, in all of our simulations, we're leaving the secondary as non-spinning. And on the z-axis, we have what we call the criticality parameter. And what that means is it's the total binary mass. So back to my definition before of binary mass as being the component masses in isolation added together, normalized by the threshold mass of an equal mass, of the equal mass non-rotating configuration. Okay, for these two equations of state, this has been studied quite thoroughly in previous works. And so this is a very, I would say, stable benchmark to do this analysis on. And so in this case, we're looking purely at the dynamical ejecta. So how much ejecta for the time frame of the simulation? So I think the longest time frame for the simulations was on the order of 35 milliseconds post-merger. So for numerical relativity simulations, full 3D and everything, this is a long time. Astrophysically, this is a short time. So yeah, but for 35 milliseconds post-merger, this is the amount of dynamical ejecta that's produced. And the interesting thing about this is the fact that it's very non-uniform once you get above a certain spin parameter. So here we have chi of 0.4. And at around 0.4, we see this non-uniform trend towards smaller mass ratio. And the peak of the dynamical ejecta actually peaks for equal mass, but massively rotating primary. And this, and for the case of the equal mass case, primary is primary only means the object that's rotating, really, since the masses are the same. While then at the same time, the I would say second most the configurations was the second most or highest amount of dynamical ejecta is the highly asymmetric and highly spinning configurations. And so you get this local minimum that forms at around 0.8. Now if we switch this view and now we look at bound material, so how much of the material that remains in the system that's bound to whatever the remnant is, we actually see similar but different opposite behavior. So we see the same minimum forming at around zero mass ratio of 0.8, but now the most massive disks are for those that are highly asymmetric and spinning, with the second most massive being on the order of the equal mass case. And we see this is fairly consistent. It's the color coding is for the material. And then it's hard to see with the dotted lines are for BHP lambda phi and the solid are for the TnTyst equation state. But more or less, we see that the same behavior applies to both equations of state. Now, conversely, now we've asked the question, okay, if in this case I have two neutron stars and they're going to form of, we think they should form of promptly collapse a black hole, but they don't. We can also ask, okay, if we do simulations with two binary neutron stars and black hole neutron stars, and we know that the binary neutron star is going to promptly collapse, is there a way to potentially tell them apart? And that's what we did in this study where in this bottom panel, we showed the five configurations that were studied for BNS and BHNS, but for two different equations of state. So this follows lines of criticality for binary neutron star systems for the two different equations of state. And in qualitatively, you see directly in the top plot here. So the first row is for obviously black hole neutron star, and this is a binary neutron star. And we see that the secondary ejection tail forms. And this is actually very fast ejection compared to the primary tidal tail that's formed that we see in both cases. But then we can also ask, okay, from this, what can we decompose this and have a better understanding of how this might differ? And so what we've done is we've taken the mass of the ejecta and we've decomposed it into the electron fraction, which is this first column, the entropy in the second column, and the velocity distribution of the ejecta in the final column. This is only for the unbound ejecta. And most significantly, we see that in the equal mass case, in the irrotational case, we actually see the most high velocity ejecta that's formed. And then as the spin of the primary increases, we see that this falls away. We see this distribution fall away, and the collision of the secondary onto the primary becomes less energetic. And then in the final case of, I would say, the highest spin that we considered, this velocity distribution pretty much overlaps. And we would say it would be even more difficult to distinguish these two events. But overall, we do see this, interestingly enough, this rapid spin up of the primary neutron star due to the collision that definitely isn't seen in the case of a black hole neutron star event and was a bit surprising to us when we did this analysis.
So can I ask a question? So this is the binary was equal mass or non-equal mass?
I'm sorry, say that again?
Is the binary equal mass here and you're only changing spin or?
No, so the this y-axis is mass ratio and this the x-axis is the effective spin of the binary, which in this case is just a function of the mass ratio since it's only spin on the primary object. And this line is the line of criticality for the equation of state. So at this mass ratio, this is the most massive primary that can be supported with, in this case, non-spinning. And then this is at 0.15 and then 0.35. And so the black hole neutron star configuration here is mass ratio of what, 0.68, and this is like 0.6, and then this is close to 0.5. And this is for the TN TYST equation of state, and for the BHP lambda phi, it's these two up here. So this is a little bit larger mass ratio.
Sorry, I didn't follow. I got lost because actually I'm looking at the plot. In particular, I'm trying to understand the velocity distribution. So you have a case at the top right that you can have the largest. Almost 80% of speed of light or no spinning. I should be able to understand that through close of first principles, and I don't. So what am I missing here? So if I compare the first, like top right to bottom right, can you describe to me the binaries I'm looking at?
Okay, so in all these cases, the total mass is 3.6 solar masses. And so the mass is constant in all these situations. However, since this is constant mass, it follows these criticality lines. So in this case, this is irrotational. So let's look at the solid lines because the solid lines, or sorry, let's look at the blue lines. So the blue lines are the Tintist equation of state. And so in the blue lines, we would have 3.6 solar mass binary total with a mass ratio of 0.68. And is non-rotating. So both objects are irrotational. In the second case, the mass is still the same at 3.6, but the mass ratio is closer to 0.6. And the primary has an effective spin of 0.15, which is, it would be 1.6 times 0.15. So this is just a function of the mass ratio at that point, right? What the spin on the primary object is. Yeah, and then the last configuration, still the same total mass, but now the mass ratio is at 0.5 and the effective spin of the binary is at 0.35, which again is just related to this function here, right? And so this the spin increase here is due to when you disrupt the less massive object, and this material hits the primary object. In the irrotational case, this is very energetic, and this is a very fast spin up, which is causing this fast ejection channel. But as you increase the spin up, in both cases you're making the system more asymmetric and increasing the spin at the same time as you move down this panel or down this column. As you change both these things, this collision becomes less energetic. So in the case of a more asymmetric system, you would expect there to be, more disruptive processes. But the fact that there's spin involved means that the collision itself is less energetic.
I don't want to stop your flow. I'm going to come back to this later. Thank you.
Okay. I think that, are there any more questions on this slide before I move on? I think that covered everything I was going to say here. Okay. So now focusing on, now that we have kind of a phenomenological understanding of how mass and spin can influence the ejecta distributions and how we could potentially distinguish these events from black hole neutron star systems, this was a parallel study that was really done, but the idea is, can we extend this understanding of the threshold mass to asymmetric and spinning binary configurations? To do that, we based our measurement of the threshold mass from the work from Koppel et al., which was the work on the equal mass irrotational configuration. And in this work, they find this relation, which I've defined as a kappa, which is a function of which relates the threshold mass here to a fit, which the fitting parameters can be pulled from the paper, but the important part is it relates to the TOV quantity, so the TOV mass, so the maximum mass that can be supported by a non-rotating neutron star, as well as the compactness of this object. And in the bottom left panel, this is just a show of their fit. So this is the threshold mass normalized by MTOV as a function of its compactness. And this is the constraints that can be set by looking at the threshold mass. So this blue line here is GW170817, which, since we saw the blue kilonova, we say that this didn't promptly collapse, which this now sets a boundary as far as what equations of state can be supported. So on the y-axis, you have the threshold mass. On the x-axis, you have the TOV mass. And these black lines are lines of constant RTOV.
My headphones died. And so this is why this model can be particularly useful, because then if we get future observations and we say, okay, statistically, we believe that these are equal mass and rotational, and we say we get like a 2.8 solar mass binary that didn't promptly collapse, then this threshold would move a little bit higher. So for this, I performed a lot of simulations, but I did it with three different equations of state. Excuse me. And you can see that they range from compactnesses, just like I mentioned at the start of this talk. And in this case, I let the secondary spin continue to be zero, and the primary spin only be between negative 0.3 and 0.3. This is the dimensionless spin. And this is, I would say, a more conservative look at what the spin of the neutron star would be. In the previous case, we looked at more extremal spins, but in this case, it's a much more conservative region to look at. But we look at mass ratios from 1 all the way down to 0.5. And in the 3D plots here, this is just the raw data. The threshold mass is a function of spin and mass asymmetry with the same axis as shown before for the three different equations of state. And upon initial review, we wondered, okay, the form, although not identical, has very similar behavior between the three equations of state. Is there a possibility to to fit this first, you know, quadratically with this ansatz that you see at the bottom. And we found that this fit incredibly well. But then we took another step and said, okay, is there the possibility to do something that's quasi-universal? And so we made the ansatz that the shape of the fit is simply the relation between the threshold mass and Q and Con. And then the scaling of this fit is a function of the equations, the equation of state. So here I define this M threshold hat, which is just the normalized threshold by this cap at EOS, where cap at EOS we set as the threshold mass relation from the equal mass rotational phase. And we find that this fit actually worked extremely well with, in most cases, an error of about 2%. But in the most extreme cases, so in this, in the highly asymmetric regime, is where you start seeing a lot of, I would say, more extreme physics that's taking place. And here is where we found that the fit behaved less well, but overall still fit reasonably. In this, we found that the threshold mass can increase by up to 10% with line spins, and can decrease by as much as 5% for anti-line spins. And more importantly, we see this non-monotonic behavior, just as we saw with the extremal spinning configurations that we looked at, where the threshold mass kind of peaks at around between 0.7 and 0.8. Now, we revisit the plot that I showed before, the only difference being that now the y-axis is the threshold mass, but it's been rescaled by the chirp factor. And here we still have this solid blue, or this horizontal blue line as the chirp mass of GW17 over 17. The gray regions are just the compactnesses that are ruled out by causality. And then our the legend for the line is actually here, where black is equal mass, blue is 0.9, pink is 0.7, green is 0.6. The plot itself is only for non-spinning. So this is both stars are non-spinning. And we see that for mass ratios that are between 0.9 and 1 really doesn't make so much of a difference and doesn't provide that much more constraint on the equation of state, depending on the mass that you look at. Whereas for 0.7, definitely for 0.5, so this is the RTOV of 11 kilometers for 0.5, can make much stronger statements as far as what the equation of state could be, or could be ruled out from an event where if we're able to take some statistical estimates and say, okay, we believe that the mass ratio is more on the lines of 0.5, this would say a lot more about what the equation of state would be. Now we can then extend this to what happens if we include spin. Now this is a lot to look at, but the trend is, I would say, more or less clear. So we have our two lines of 11 kilometers and 10 kilometers. And as you increase the spin, these all shift upwards. As you decrease the spin, these all shift downwards. And so the takeaway from this is that if we believe that if we see a binary neutron star detection and you know, we think there's some certainty that the primary has some appreciable spin on it, there's going to be less constraints that could be put on the equation of state. Conversely, if there's some sort of inclination that we believe that there's a negative spin in the or an anti-aligned spin in the binary, that this would actually provide more constraints on the equation of state. So if we detected something that's GW170817 mass-wise, but that didn't promptly collapse, we would actually be able to put even more constraints than we did in the last time. Inversely, if we have some detection that we don't know anything about, and we measure a chirp mass, we can then use this relation to say, okay, I have now a surface in terms of Q and chi of this given threshold mass. What's my likelihood of seeing some sort of electromagnetic counterpart? And so this has a dual purpose as far as the model goes. Now, if we switch to what sort of signatures an extreme binary neutron star could have, this is a plot of in the top row of the time of peak luminosity. And in the bottom row is the actual peak luminosity. And this is as a function of the remnant spin. So we take this, we rescale everything by this criticality parameter that I discussed. And this is just saying that the remnant spin is a function of the amount of angular momentum lost through gravitational waves, as well as the mass that's lost through gravitational waves. And again, we see this nonlinear behavior where the peak luminosity is actually reserved for the equal mass. So the mass ratio is this color bar on the side. And the least luminous events are these on the order of the 0.8 mass ratio. However, the time of peak luminosity tends to be reserved for the more highly spinning cases, as one would expect, with the lower spins having the earliest peak luminosity time. And one can easily ask why we would still expect to see the peak luminosity of the irrotational equal mass being so large. And to give kind of a qualitative reasoning behind this, we have here the most, we have here a highly spinning configuration. So this is a chi of 0.6 with equal mass 0.8 and a q of 0.6. And in the case of the equal mass, we actually see that the highly spinning object actually gets tidally disrupted by the more compact but equally massive secondary object. Whereas later on, these, you know, in the case of Q 0.8, this seems more like it looks almost symmetric, even though it's not. In the case of 0.6, we see what is normally expected, which is the less massive object being very highly disrupted before merger. And so essentially what we're seeing in the equal mass case is exactly what we saw in the black hole neutron star runs. Where or the comparison between black hole neutron stars and binary neutron stars, where the disruption of the, in this case, the highly spinning one is having this high energy collision with the non-spinning star, which is causing this rapid spin up and this fast ejection channel that we saw could have a lot of ejected mass in the system. And so this is one way, even though it's more qualitative, this gives some physical intuition as far as why this is A, generating so much ejected mass, and B, why these events are potentially so luminous.
Samuel, so in this plot, so your T minus T merger, so helping define T merger, because I'm just trying to see if this is a comparison at the same stage of the binary merger.
Yeah, so I mean, in these cases, the merger time is the, for each of these is measured at the peak of the strain.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay. Switching now to gravitational waves for the extreme binary neutron star mergers. This only shows the data sets that were either metastable or had long-term stability. Otherwise, this would be even more incomprehensible to read. So I apologize because there's so much data here. But the solid lines denote the 2-2 mode. So M equals 2, L equals to 2. And the dotted lines represent the L equal 2, M equal to 1 mode. And the left is the Tintist equation of state, and the right is the BHP lambda phi equation of state. And the most interesting feature is the fact that for both equations of state, we see this for highly asymmetric and highly spinning configurations, we see the significant growth in the 2-1 mode, so the one-arm instability, and to the point where it actually almost meets the current sensitivity curve of LIGO. This is the purple line in the top. And it would actually be well within the range of the Einstein telescope in the future. And so what this tells us is that when we're at a point where we're able to detect the post-merger frequencies, which we hope to in the future gravitational wave detectors, this can actually give us a lot of insight with regards to spin and asymmetry of the system. Even more interesting is that the one arm instability is actually for a given spin configuration is actually reserved for the Q of 0.8. So the one that we saw is the minimum with regards to, you know, ejected mass or dynamical or disk mass is actually the one that gives the strongest 2-1 signal in the post-merger frequencies. We don't have a good understanding as far as why, like there's no, I would say, physical intuition other than the fact that the 0.8 region parameter space is kind of this happy medium between spin and asymmetry where just enough matter is thrown out into the bound and unbound system so that it can be metastable while at the same time having enough matter left in the hypermassive neutron star to create this very strong one-arm instability. Because as we decrease the mass ratio to 0.6 and more mass is ejected into the system, it still has a strong one-arm instability, but it's weaker. Yeah, so this is the point that I would like to make with this.
So there you have an R null, right? Which is the total mass of the system. So if I go over the total mass of the system, of course the frequency would change, but you could have for a different mass ratio, the most likely case for the M equal one mode, right? I mean, you were saying, I mean, I like your explanation is that, okay, you need to throw out some amount of matter because otherwise you collapse in a black hole. But okay, for the same equation state, the merger where the individual masses are lower, so that the merger still is happily within what the equation state will prevent from collapsing properly to a black hole and have the M equal one. So I mean that point A that you're seeing is will fluctuate depending on the total mass of the system that is coming together.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And so I mean in these cases, so the legend here is saying that for all of the simulations shown for the Tintus equation of state, all of these are the same mass. So these are all 5% above the threshold mass. Whereas in the case of the BHB lambda, you have 5% and 2.5%. And the 2.5%, you know, fall further down. So you're absolutely right. Okay. Now all the works that I've looked at up until this. Yeah.
Sorry to interrupt, but if I could just ask one question here before you move on. So, yeah. So you mentioned this is you mentioned the one arm instability. So do you still see this peak for the equal mass case? It's just not as prominent as the unequal mass ratio.
Yeah. So here, if you can see my pointer, this brown line is the equal mass, but with a chi of 0.6. And I think the colors are kind of close, but in this case, you don't really see anything with regards to the 0.45 because it's way down in the noise floor. So you see some sort of increase, which, I mean, you can expect, right? Like I showed in this plot here, where you see the tidal disruption of the spinning star. I mean, that naturally is going to add some sort of an instability. It's just not going to be, you know, so prominent in this case.
Right, okay. It's kind of like an order of magnitude increase with respect to like the equal mass ratio.
I would say order of magnitude is probably reasonable. Yeah.
Yeah. Thanks.
Now, up until this point, all the work has been done with, you know, I would say well researched equations of state that have that have been around for a few years, but they're purely hadronic, so there's no quark matter material whatsoever. In the case of the BHB lambda 5, there's some hyperons that are taken into consideration in the model, but in this final work, I want to, or I guess I should wrap up pretty quickly. Sorry about that. The point of this was to look at a novel equation of state that includes a first order phase transition while still having a temperature and electron fraction dependence. It is, like I said, it's hybrid. So this diagram kind of lays out what its construction is based on. But in this way, we actually are able to get some sort of a physical meaning to what, or some, I would say, physical motivation to what the first order phase transition is, as opposed to using some arbitrary fits to the energy density versus pressure diagram. In this case, we had three models, which this is the mass radius diagram for the three different models. And the parameters are tuned in order to kind of extend the total parameter space of what's allowed based off current observations. And in this work, we looked at GW17-08-17 like binaries and how quarks are formed in this case. And unlike previous works that used either polytropic equations of state or some other form to model the phase transition, we actually don't see a huge difference in the spectra. In some cases, you would see like very wild frequency distributions in the post-merger spectra. And in our case, we actually don't see this at all. And we actually see that the spectra actually matches extremely well, except with the sharp cutoff in terms of when the collapse took place. And this is due to the fact that in our equation of state, as you can kind of see here, is that at the maximum mass that can be supported, the transition to quark matter actually softens the equation of state and always reduces to a phase-induced collapse. Whereas other models that end up with a stiffening in the equation of state, they might produce some sort of metastable quark star or something like that. And this is why you get some of these more exotic modes. I know you said 10 minutes, so I think that's kind of like the main point from this. But if there's more questions on this, I can talk about it during the Q&A. So I'll just skip to my summary. Sorry to kind of speed through the last couple of slides, but I would like to leave enough time for questions and answers. So, the point of this work is, especially in the binary neutron star community, there's been a lot of focus on irrotational and asymmetric binaries, with some work being focused on the eccentricity of the binary. However, spin and asymmetry together have not been looked at too much. And I think part of this is due to the fact that the initial data hasn't been there before. Fuka is publicly available, so I hope this will enable other people to kind of look into this area of research, because there's a huge portion of the parameter space that's still left to explore. And there's obviously a lot of important physics that are taking place in this regime, which I think is going to be very meaningful to the future models for gravitational waves and for kilonova and multi-messenger observables. So I hope this was interesting for you. And if there's questions, please let me know.
Maybe I can ask one. So you show this fitting for Emmett's threshold as a function of this mass ratio and spin and equation of state. But it seems you only use three equation of states for generating the fitting formula, like you actually trust it. I mean, if you test it with more equation states, do you think whether this fitting formula will still true or?
Yeah, that's completely fair. So that's this is why I come back to this slide for a moment, because here I showed the compactnesses. So there's, I would say, two main features of an equation of state, especially for purely hadronic ones. There's the compactness and the tidal deformability that tend to more or less give you some insights as to what the characteristics are going to be. And in this case, the range of compactnesses that we looked at, this is why we chose the three equations of state that we did, because it essentially goes, I would say, towards the edges of what's considered reasonable ranges of compactnesses. And so in the intermediate regime, we have confidence that the model holds fairly well because we've kind of expanded the search in this regime. Looking at quark matter, that's the different story. I know there's been some works from Perego and Kashyap, where they've looked at some threshold mass relations with, that include quark matter. I think Bausfahn did as well. And this really, depends on the equation of state that's used. Again, as I mentioned it very briefly, but some quark matter's equation of state will result in a stiffening of the equation of state. Others will result in a softening of the equation of state. And depending on which ones you use will depend on whether or not the model will lead to a higher threshold mass or a lower threshold mass. But overall, so long as they exist within this, you know, parameter or this compactness range, I would assess that it holds fairly well, but more equations of state would only refine the model more, and that's would be helpful. And we've seen this already with the equal mass eurotational and the asymmetric and eurotational threshold mass studies, where I mean, people are now pushing into 20 different equations of state. Some of them are even ruled out by current astrophysical models. It's just building the statistics on whether or not it's quasi-universal or not. And I think this field will benefit from it. But as you can see, this is already this is my first time doing this, so I probably used more simulations than should have been needed. But this is already a very large parameter space to get. I mean, these are 36 different configurations, and as a first crack at it, we think we landed very well on a relation that seems to work quite reasonably. But as more people look at this, and if they, the work from Perego, they don't. They had contradicting results where they didn't think that it was a quasi-universal because in some of these softer equations of state, they saw a drastic decrease in the threshold mass as you went to higher asymmetries. And so I think as the community continues to look at this, we'll get a better understanding of whether or not this model will hold. But more or less, I think it gives a reasonable approximation.
Cool. Any other questions?
Yeah, can we go to Biplot? Unless someone else. Can we go to that panel again? Will, I think, is trying to answer.
No.
No? Okay.
Go ahead.
So, sorry, Samuel, I'm just going to ask, I'm still lost here. So, let me just ask two specific cases. So I'm looking at the top right, there's a blue line. So it's fairly constant. So I have ejecta and a whole bunch of velocities. And can you lower that? Now I cannot see. Okay, there it is. So and it goes all the way to very high velocities. And now I'm going to go to the bottom one that it only goes to 0.4, let's say, in the solid line. So there is total mass is the same. We're talking about a black hole neutron star system.
The total mass of the binary is the same, but this is just the fraction of the ejecta. So this is
That's right. I want to try and understand the velocity distribution. Mm-hmm. So they're both black hole neutron stars, they both have total mass 3.6. And the only difference is that there's a spin in the neutron star or in the black hole that is 0 versus 0.35.
So in all cases, the spin parameter is the same for the more massive object, whether or not it's a neutron star or a black hole.
Okay, so let me look at just the blue line. So what are the blue lines?
So the blue lines are where the equation of state used to the equation of state that is used is the Tintest equation of state. So in the case of a black hole neutron star system, the secondary, the less compact object is described with this equation of state. And in the case of a binary neutron star, both objects are described by this equation of state. Okay, and the red line is just with regards to the BHB lambda phi equation of state. And the dotted is the black hole neutron star configurations.
The mass ratio is also different.
Yeah, I just want to understand what is the key thing that is making the difference. So the black hole, so the top block, you say the solid is a black hole neutron star, or is it a binary neutron star?
The solid line is the binary neutron star, and the black hole is this one. Is the dotted lines. Yeah.
And the bottom one is what?
I mean, the bottom one, they overlap. Yeah.
Right.
So there's no red line because we couldn't create a stable in spiral for this critical configuration. So it's just the Tintest equation of state that's looked at in this final panel.
I don't want any more details except what I'm asking, because otherwise I get lost. So I'm looking at a black hole neutron star with zero spin, another black hole neutron star with 0.35. The total mass is 3.6 in both cases.
Yep.
The only difference is the mass ratio and the spin.
Correct.
And you use the term the collision is less, there's less energy in the collision. So there are two competing effects. So I can have a more violent collision if I have a spin, because my object is now, let's say the black hole is tighter in some sense, the ISCO is smaller, but at the same time, I also have to fight as I go out with the ejector. You have to climb the potential well out. So I'm just trying to say, do you have an intuition of what makes something be able to expel a significant amount at 0.7 versus none? So I'm claiming this should be understandable by first principles. So do you have that understanding? Or
I have my best understanding is what I've said, right? Is that, you know, in the case of the black hole, this configurations of the black hole, what you see are fairly consistent. I see a lot of change with black hole in terms of spin. Whereas in the case of the binary neutron star, the only difference between these two scenarios, or I would say the only key difference between these two scenarios is in fact the collision, right? Because in the case of, is the collision of nuclear matter, and there's this, this transfer of torque and spinning and torque and momentum to the non-spinning object, which is contributing to this energetic spin up and this ejection of the matter. This was our takeaway. Now, whether or not that's 100% correct, I mean, I'd say it's open for further analysis, but that was our takeaway from this initial analysis.
All right, thank you.
So, Luciano, you have a question?
I think Will had a question before.
Thanks, Samuel, for the nice talk. I just want to ask kind of a big picture question about the initial data, sort of in terms of what parts of parameter space the sort of initial data scheme that you set out isn't able to cover, and what you're thinking about in terms of new places to go. So is my understanding correct that it can only do align spins currently? And have you thought any about misaligning the neutron star spins? Is that on the to-do list or?
Yeah, so as far as parameter space that's capable of exploring I released the second version last year, which was a big step in, I would say, reliability, especially with regards to black hole neutron star initial data, as well as computing highly asymmetric mainly highly asymmetric configurations. And I'm working on a paper now to show that, you know, I can scale this up to mass ratios on the order of, you know, 0.01, which, you know, you can, it's to be determined how important these numerical simulations are going to be. I mean, obviously this is going to be mainly binary black holes, but anyway, this the solver is shown to be very reliable for these highly asymmetric regimes. The issue with regards to spin, you are correct, these are only for aligned spins. And the issue with precession is that, you know, you can't have, in Kadeth, there's a strict Z symmetry that's imposed on the system of equations. And I've talked to Philippe about it, and it's not a priority for him to relax this. And so then the only other way to get around this would be to decompose all the equations into symmetric and anti-symmetric components, which then increases the number of unknowns in the system. And Kadeth is already very computationally expensive, and so it would become very prohibitive. So right now there's no plan to do precession. But in terms of asymmetric and aligned spins and eccentricity, that we cover extremely well.
Okay, thanks.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, thank you, Samuel, for the nice talk. I have two quick questions. So the first one is to explore, as related to Will's question, to explore this this phase space of all the possible binary configurations. You had to write down this code, but there are already like available elliptical solvers like Lorin, as you sure know. So I was wondering, what are the like, if you can summarize very briefly the technical features of the code that allows you to actually compute this, let's say with respect to this like other or older elliptical solvers.
Yeah. Let's see, my slide will work. So the key feature between Lorraine and Kadeth, among a lot of them, but with regards to the domains, so as my understanding with Lorraine, the domain decomposition is, I would say, overlapping ellipsoids and things like that with. Okay, I don't know the structure very well. I haven't developed to it. But there's a very different domain decomposition. And one of the main features of Kadeth is this bispherical decomposition. And the other feature is that it allows for adaptive surfaces. So for stellar objects, we can define the surface of the star as an actual domain boundary, even if the shape of this boundary changes. And then we can have a continuous coordinate map due to this bispherical decomposition out to, as I said, it uses a compactified domain, which extends out to, we'll say infinity, mm-hmm. where we can make well-defined, depending on your resolution, you can have well-defined integrals for your ADM quantums. The other advantage to it is that, and this was a feature that I implemented in I took advantage of for the V2 solvers, is the addition of spherical boundaries or spherical shells around the object. So, you know, you see this, it's okay, it's small, but you see the spherical shell that's connected to the bispherical domains, and this black or this dark blue region, that's the actual excised region. And you can add shells within these two regions in a well-defined manner, such that you can have resolution where you need it. And this becomes important when you go to either, you know, near equal mass in the case of neutron stars and black holes, or, you know, highly asymmetric binary black hole systems, where unlike, you know, say like the two puncture code, which it has like a unit grid setup, you have to increase your resolution in the entire domain. Whereas in Kadeth, I can just add spherical shells nearby, and I can leave the resolution more coarse where I don't need it. And then, you know, I have, you know, we've implemented the ability to take a solution and increase the resolution later. So that's one of the things with Lorraine. My understanding is, you know, the solution you get is the solution you get, and there's no changing it later. Mm-hmm. In our case, you can get a coarse resolution solution, you can evolve it and say, or you can plot it. You know, I have Python codes where you can plot the initial data solution and actually interpolate it to see how the constraint violations look in the numerical domain. I'm sorry, in the physical space. And in this way, you can say, okay, maybe this is too coarse of a resolution. I can take this data set and I can feed it back into to get higher resolution. And this is a way to kind of balance the cost of the initial data. I mean, at the end of the day, Lorraine is very good at what it does, right? It, you know, for isolated solutions, it's very fast. For equal mass, and even some, I know some people who can get asymmetric initial data out of it. It can do it, and I would say a bit faster for the binary case. I believe it can compute the initial data faster. However, I would say, I mean, we can do the misaligned spins. And we can do extremal spins, which I don't believe Lorraine can do. And I have a lot of control with regards to higher asymmetry, which I know Lorraine struggles with getting solutions for that. And this is, again, in part due to the grid setup, and it's also in part to how the solver works. But as far as other elliptic solvers, I don't have so much familiarity outside of Lorraine. I've talked to Alireza, who's the developer of Elliptica. And he has a different but similar approach to solving things numerically as Cadeth does. But I believe he can do precession with his code. But he hasn't published so many papers with it. So I think he's only published like his two code papers, and I haven't seen anything else from it. So
I see. Interesting. And my other very good question is, maybe you mentioned this, when you studied the threshold mass, usually the time of collapse in these simulations are not the problem collapse, but just the, you know, normal collapse in binary neutron star mergers, say, it's very, it doesn't converge, right? You do it in different resolutions and you see different times. And so is it the same in the prompt collapse case? So do you see some convergence when you change the resolution?
Yeah, so in all these cases, or I'd say in the initial runs I did, we did two resolutions, and we saw that the computing the threshold mass was, I think, within 1% between the low resolution and high resolution. We didn't do like three resolution studies, but it is true that the collapse time can be significantly different depending on the resolution. But that was something that we looked at to ensure that the value that we were measuring was reliable.
I see. Cool. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Any other questions?
I have a quick question. You said you were applying excision to the black holes. What are you doing the black holes with?
So in all of our simulations with black holes, we use the Turducken approach. So we do eighth order Lagrangian fit just outside the excision region, and then we extrapolate it into the interior.
Okay, so if no more questions, let's send me again to the next talk.
Thank you.